I'm fond of pigs. Dogs look up to us. Cats look down on us. Pigs treat us as equals. Welcome back to CivCast. And welcome back to me, myself. It's been a while. It's good to be back on the... Would you call this a radio, Wouter? Is this a radio? Some kind of radio?
It is kind of a radio thing. I would call it a podcast because that's what it is, but...
Radio podcast. It's good to be back, it's good to be back in your ears, folks. My name is Dan, and I'm not going to say my... You know what? And my co-host is Wouter, and this is CivCast. And stuff is definitely different. If you're listening to this, you might be a little surprised to hear my voice and not the soothing, dulcet tones of our good friend Kyle Dempster. And Wouter, perhaps it'd be best if you talk to the folks a little bit about what went on here and what's going on pertaining to CivCast and Kyle not being on the show today.
Yeah, so we had a little bit of a shakeup. Kyle has decided that he wasn't going to be recording as the host of CivCast anymore because he wanted to take a break. He hasn't been playing the game so much anymore. He was kind of burned out on it, and he just didn't feel like he could contribute very well to the conversation if he wasn't playing anymore. So what he asked is if I and Dan perhaps want to continue his work with him moving backwards to more of a producer kind of setting. I feel so official when I say we have a producer, Dan.
We can put it in the credits.
So Kyle is very much still here with CivCast. He's just not as a host position. And Kyle, we love you for everything you have done and doing. And I hope you're listening as well.
Yeah, of course. CivCast is Kyle's Kyle's baby. And, you know, Wouter and I have been around. Well, I mean, I wasn't around for the past couple months there. But Wouter and I have been around for a while with him. And everything... you know, pertaining to the show is a manifestation of his vision and his idea for it. And so everything we do, you know, here going on forward is because, you know, A, he is allowing us to, because ultimately this is still, you know, his product, and B, because he created it. So we will certainly do our best to, you know, move forward in the spirit of what we had going before. We will definitely try and be as consistent as possible on a weekly basis for our recordings. Wouter and I have moved some stuff around in our schedules. Both of us have, of course, you know, pretty busy schedules, all things considered. It's not easy to get a time for two people to hook up to record for an hour and a half, if you include the planning part. And, you know, life sometimes gets in the way, but we'll certainly try to do it on a weekly basis. And that is the goal. Right, Wouter?
Very much so. And I'm pretty sure we will succeed most of the time, so we'll get there.
Exactly. We want to bring consistency back for you guys, so we'll do our best with that. What's new with you, buddy?
Not so much. We finally have some good weather down here in the Netherlands. Starts almost to feel like summer. And actually I'm still playing Civ quite a lot. I really like the expansion, and it didn't bum me out yet. I still keep turning back.
Good. Likewise. And if you guys hear clicking in the background, it's because I'm literally in the middle of a game right now. I'm playing a Scotland game, surprise, surprise. And I am currently being besieged by England, surprise, surprise. but yeah, well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that you're playing as much as you are. I know that I have been playing it as much as I can, particularly since Rise and Fall, which definitely brought me back into the fold on the game. I think that the improvements they've made have been fantastic. And I haven't had a chance to talk to you guys on the radio podcast thing. I haven't been able to yell at your ears about my thoughts about the expansion. So I think that's probably going to be the crux of what we talk about today.
Yeah, sounds great. Because okay. I'm really, cool. Really curious to hear what you feel about some of the expansion decisions, actually.
Yeah, well, with regards to the expansion itself, I mean, I'll fully admit that after September, after, you know, my wife and I welcomed our son into the world, I didn't play a lot of Civ. I didn't play a lot of anything, as you might imagine. And, you know, throughout the year, at least leading up to February, I would dabble every once in a while. It wasn't as though like I wasn't enjoying the game, and it wasn't as though I wasn't still wanting to play. I wasn't really playing anything. I was working too much, and then having to make sure that everything with the kid and with the move was happening. But you know, around January, I went on to YouTube and I went on to the Civ channel, and I was started watching all the videos and all the new Civs and new mechanics that they had planned, and it really psyched me up. Like I was particularly in love with some of the Civ choices, obviously, as well as some of the cool ideas behind, you know, eras and governors and those mechanics and such. And I definitely feel like I haven't been let down. I definitely feel like they've integrated mostly everything in a pretty comprehensive and satisfactory way. So I'm feeling really positive about it. But I think the best place to start, judging from the feedback that people have on the Reddit, is kind of with more of a strategic discussion. And I love talking about the Civs and the ins and outs of, you know, all these new Civs and the positives and negatives. So I know one of our favorite listener, one of our favorite segments for listeners, I guess, was always the tier list, and was always Voucher's tiers and his discussions about who's uber strong, who's god tier, and who's crap tier, and who needs about 18 buffs before they're even viable. So perhaps that would be a good place to start. Of all of the rise and fall Civs, who do you consider to be the strongest in, like, and I know it's situational, but in just a general sense, and who do you think is most in need of the buff stick?
I think that Korea by far wins the cake when it goes to stronger civilization from the expansion. Their special district is a science district, which means the special district means that it is only 50% cost. It gives a flat +4 output for adjacency. The only downside is it has to place on a hill, and you can't place any other districts next to it. Beyond that, they will also get science from mines and food from farms if they are adjacent to their science district, which is amazing. And they get extra culture and science if there's a governor established in the city, which means you just want to have about the amount of cities that there are governors, get every governor as soon as possible, and rock in another +10 culture and +10 science for your entire civilization. These are all really, really powerful. And if you combine, like, the Seiwon, which is their science district, together with a policy card that will double the adjacency bonus or something like that, which is not that hard to get, it's quite early in the game already, then you go up to a +8 adjacency bonus for every district, and that's +8 science for every city, flat. And that's just really powerful. I know that before the game was launched, it was even more powerful. They nerfed it already, and I can see a nerf coming again. This is
I think I saw on the Civ subreddit that someone had achieved a science victory in like turn like 65 or something. I think that might be hyperbole, but something absolutely insane. And I mean, I haven't played Korea yet, but I've been in a game against them, and I feel like even on Emperor difficulty, you can't beat them in science. And that was the case too in Civ 5, from what I remember. They were a powerhouse in science
too. Oh, right? Yes. Korea was one of my favorites to play in Civ 5 because I liked the science game a lot. They weren't as overpowered as they are here. They were powerful, definitely, but not as overpowered as here.
Oh, no, absolutely. They feel like... I feel like a science victory with them is par for the course. I think that the one game I've been in, Rise and Fall, where Korea's been there, I was very, very quick to try and subjugate them to put them down, because I knew that if I didn't, and I like winning science victories as well, I stood no chance.
Yeah, they snowball out of control really quickly if you don't deal with them. Unlike most of the other Civs, this Civ already starts from the direct beginning. You unlock the Seiwon really quickly with writing. And unlike the other Civs, you will literally start a snowball from the moment the game pretty much starts if you don't stop her. It's kind of like what happened with the Zulus in Civ 5. If you saw the Zulus, you had to contain them really quickly, or otherwise you would know they would outpower you militarily later in the game.
Yeah. Is there a natural... I mean, it probably is a silly question when you're so good at something, but is there a natural secondary victory condition to segue into with Korea? I feel like militarily she's decent. Like, her unique unit's pretty strong.
Her unique unit is pretty strong. It cannot move and attack in the same turn, which I always hate when that happens.
Yeah.
Because you're so strong at science, you do have access to a lot of advanced military units on an earlier stage. Therefore, domination victory would definitely be a very good secondary option.
Okay, good. So Korea, I mean, I think that's a pretty universal sentiment, is that she's definitely, if not overpowered, she's certainly the strongest of all the civs they have introduced since Rise and Fall. Who needs a little love? Who needs a little bit of a back massage and a spa day maybe from Firaxis?
In my opinion, that is not a hard choice. It's unfortunately Lotaro from Machu Picchu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, he is just... I have a feeling that his abilities are a little bit all over. There is some cohesiveness to it, but not really a strong one. And they just amount to absolutely nothing put together.
Yeah, so you're very diplomatic and very generous when you say that his abilities are all over. I have a feeling his abilities just suck. I mean, he's one of the two that I haven't actually started a game with. The other one being Georgia, I haven't played with yet. But I look at Swift Hawk and do you have it up? Can you say exactly what Swift Hawk is? Go ahead.
If a Machu Picchu unit defeats an enemy unit within the borders of the enemy city, that city loses 20 loyalty.
Big freaking deal, right? Like, that's it? That's all he gets from his unique ability, yeah.
I mean, loyalty can be important, but the only way that when it becomes important is if you can actually get somebody down to zero loyalty. And I do not see that happening unless that person or AI is really stupid, has a lot of units around the city, already being pressure put upon the city so that its loyalty is dropping, so that you have a couple of turns to actually bring down its loyalty. And that you just kill a lot of units in the vicinity, which even the AI shouldn't do if it knows, like, oh, my loyalty is really low at the moment. I'm gaining my loyalty back, so I should call back my units a little bit so that I don't lose my city literally because he's killing my units. I have never seen it happen either, actually. So I think there is something like that inside of the game, which makes Swift Hawk completely useless.
Yeah, for sure. I think I've seen Mapuche once, maybe once in a game, and he was a non-factor. So certainly I haven't interacted with him enough to be any sort of expert on it. But on the surface, his abilities, his two abilities are underwhelming. His unique unit, is it any good? What is it? I'm just bringing him up on Civ. The Toki?
The Malun Raider.
Oh, sorry, the Malun Raider. Toki is his ability. That's right.
Yeah. It's not that special. It gets another 5 combat strength bonus if within 4 hexes of friendly territory. So it gets a little bit stronger if you are fighting a border war. What also means if you want to push through an entire civilization, you have to take every city that you capture. And you can't raise, which I like to do usually, like not taking every city unless they are like an important city. And that makes it more difficult. And you already talked about their other ability, the Toki. And their units get a little bit of extra experience in combat if there's a governor established in a city where they were trained. And they get +10 combat strength bonus against civilizations that are in Golden Age. Which is, +10 combat bonus is definitely not the worst. Definitely not.
That's good. Yeah.
But
promotion bonuses.
So. Yeah, but, you know, it's so situational. Because there will be a lot of times that your neighbors, because you want to fight your neighbors based upon his other abilities, aren't in a Golden Age. And at that point, you have to wait until it actually until it happens that they are in a golden age, and that can timing-wise not work out. When you get your Melon Raiders, for example, you would like to use them most likely to have a border war with your neighbors. And if none of your neighbors have any golden age at that point, then yeah, then it's gonna be really tricky. Also, in the Golden Age, people will have more loyalty in their cities, which doesn't combine well with his first ability to reduce loyalty when units are killed. So it just doesn't fit well together.
Yeah, fair enough. There's definitely a lot that can be done there, but maybe this is just one of those sieves that I feel like there's a couple sieves like that in the game right now that just feel like they're, unless you really, really want to try them. I feel like they kind of are a bit inaccessible. Right now, I'm not really feeling Japan. I feel like maybe even since the beginning, I felt like they're a bit underwhelming. I also am really not feeling India, even with Chandragupta. But who knows? Maybe I didn't see on the spring update video that they were going to be doing anything with Mapuche. Is that right? They're not going to do anything with it?
I didn't hear anything about it either. I wouldn't be surprised if they did some tweaking there. I think they're going to look at a lot of civs, just to keep like the balance rolling and everything like that. But yeah, we'll have to see. We'll also have to see how it will turn out once they fix the bug thingy. I don't know if you got wind of that beforehand.
Yeah, I did. I did.
So
A little
yeah. Yeah, so for the people who don't know it, maybe it would be smart to say so. Religion has been a powerful motivating force throughout human history, but some civilizations' six AIs are a little into religion at the expense of, well, pretty much everything else. It is a real bug, and it is all because of a typo. So there is in the database, there is yield is spelled wrong. It's spelled with the A and the E backwards, which so it does.
Triggered.
It says like yield production instead of yield production, which means that some civilizations were too much focused on going for the religious stuff because these are modifiers to guide a civilization on what to do. You have one for faith, gold, culture, science, and production. And because of this, they focused way too much on religion. And even civilizations that had nothing really special to do with religion. Every civilization has kind of its own priorities and everything like that. But yeah, with this small typo, religion was a higher priority for pretty much everybody, which usually means that they are weaker. Because religion is not the be all end all. It probably also would explain why we always saw such large spams of missionaries and apostles in higher level game difficulties. I don't know if you've ever had like a sea of missionaries coming to your country,
Yes,
literally washing
yes,
over. I think that
yes.
it's also probably coming from that bug. And with that,
Well, I see.
I hope that all the civilizations will be like to play against at least a little bit more competitive and like focusing on their own strengths.
You say religion isn't the be all and end all, Valter, but religion is literally supposed to be the be all and end all. That's the point of religion.
Unfortunately, we're playing approximation of reality.
I know, I know. I felt the need to meme that one out.
Oh yeah, definitely.
That's fair. That's fair. I feel like getting great profit is significantly harder now than it was before. If you're playing a civ that doesn't have any inherent religious bonuses, I know in at least two of my games, one where I was playing Scotland and one where I was playing Indonesia, no, Khmer, I don't think I got a great profit, and that really sucks for Khmer because they're pretty faith-based. So.
Yeah, there really are.
Okay, so another big thing that drew me to Rise and Fall was I feel like the devs, they must be listening to this podcast and specifically to you and I, because they cater directly to us, Valter. There's a Dutch civ, a Scottish civ, and a pseudo pre-Confederation Canadian civ, which I think
Yeah.
runs the entire gamut for us.
And
So,
if you take what's in the expansion as well, with a lot of things we've talked about, government districts, reworking of the alliances and stuff like that, I think we might have some listeners over at Firaxis.
Okay, so Firaxis, the next thing you could do is you can send us future expansion CD keys, or not CD keys. God, I sound old when I say that. Steam keys to our...
Full disclosure, I do get a free copy of the expansion from 2K.
Well, aren't you fancy?
Yeah.
Gonna have to hook me up on that next time. what do you think of Wilhelmina and the Dutch? I know you had this discussion with Kyle before, but I haven't played her yet, and so I defer to you completely. But she seems like a delightful old lady. She seems like the kind of lady that you'd see at church one day, and then the next day would be beating you down with that umbrella she's holding in that picture.
She was quite religious as well. I'm really glad about her choice, actually. She's a great choice, I think. The obvious one would be going from Willem of Orange or something like that, which has been done pretty much every time, I guess.
Yeah.
And I'm glad they went for somebody else. And Wilhelmina was our queen during the Second World War. And I think it was a good choice to choose her. In general, I like the boulders, actually. First of all, they are beautiful on the map. I don't know if you had a chance to play against her and see some boulders on the map.
Yes, they are beautiful.
And I love, and I keep reiterating it, but I love the fact that they put a little bit of extra detail to it, that they keep changing throughout the ages with certain technologies that you unlock that improve the boulder. The look of the boulder also changes, which I find amazing that they put they put a little bit of extra effort in the boulders just because they're awesome.
Cool. That's awesome. Yeah, and so the polder, for those of you who might not have the game up right in front of you right now, unlocks the builder ability to construct a polder unique to Netherlands, plus one food and plus one production, plus one food if adjacent to a polder improvement. Additional production, gold, and food as you advance through the civics and technology tree, which is kind of neat, but also seems a bit ad hoc. Must be placed on a coast or lake tile adjacent to three or more land tiles. Makes sense. And increases movement cost of tile to three. So, yeah, I mean, it seems pretty solid all around. What is that production, gold, and food bonus as you advance through the civics and tech tree like?
It's pretty decent. It just makes sure that the improvement keeps up on par with the rest of the improvements that get bonuses throughout the game. So nothing really special, just the general couple of extra production and food bonuses. It just makes sure that it keeps up with the rest of the improvements.
Okay, and so with regards to, and just correct me already, please. Des Eaux Provinciennes and Grotte Riveren, what are your thoughts on those?
I actually do not hate your pronunciation of that.
Oh, thank God. I've been studying up for 2 minutes.
The ship one is called Des Eaux Provinciennes. Which means the seven provinces. It is actually pretty good. It's a really, really strong ship. And if you play on like an island map or something like that, it is very, very useful to kick down some city walls and stuff like that. It's nice. Quite powerful.
Nice.
The Grote Rivieren, which means great rivers, is not that great in my opinion. The Culture Bomb, adjacent tiles when completing a harbor is not that useful because those are usually on coastal tiles, sometimes on lake tiles. And if it is not a lake tile, then it might be useful a little bit. But on the coastal tiles, I don't really care that much if I get a couple of extra culture bomb tiles out of there. I would rather steal some nice places with Poland's culture bomb, for example.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, so go ahead.
Yeah, the major adjacency bonuses, like you were going to say, they're okay. They're nothing special, and that's the best I can say about it. The Grote Rivieren is not a great ability. It's nice to have, but it's not worth strength slay.
Okay, and Radio Aranya seems pretty strong too. I mean, anything with trade routes I like, and I like the way that they've remodeled and rejigged Traitor. It's a little bit with Rise and Fall. I think it's looking pretty good.
Yeah, it really pushes you towards being that friendly old lady that's friends with everybody and that everybody wants to send their trade routes to you as well, which means making some nice alliances so that they will also see the benefit from getting your trade routes with you, get that bonus from the specific alliance and stuff like that. And that will also increase the speed of the alliance leveling up, which will tie in well together. So you'll get strong, powerful alliances with a lot of trade routes that get some great yields for you. Perfect. I love it.
Good. And yeah, look at her. You don't want to make her mad. You want to be allies with her. Like, you don't want to piss that lady off.
Have you seen the animation where she gets angry or something when she declares war?
No, man, I haven't gone.
It is beautiful. It's just... you see her smile disappearing from her face, grabbing that umbrella, and you just want to run for your life.
That's awesome. Well, I'm glad. I'm glad that you liked them. When they rolled them out, that they were what you were looking for. I like what they did with Scotland. I'll tell you that much.
Oh yeah.
I mean. First of all, it had to be Robert the Bruce, and the fact that his ability is Bannockburn is great. In the current game I'm in right now with Scotland, which is my second, I haven't actually declared a war of liberation yet. I don't know if I've necessarily seen anything that meets the pre. If anything, someone should be declaring a war of liberation on me because I'm kicking the crap out of Brazil.
I think that's probably why there is no war of liberation. You're just an aggressor on the continent.
That's just so ahistorical, but all right, why not? Scottish Enlightenment's great. I'm going for a science victory in this game, and you know, happy cities generating the great scientist points, the great engineer points, and giving you the +5 science and production. I think it seems pretty strong to me as I play it. I was just doing a statistical play out. I have 6 major cities right now, and I purposely in quotations, none of them were happy at one point. And so I looked and saw how much science I was getting per turn. And I was about 83.1 per turn. And then I made all 6 of them happy. And then the science I was busting out was 107.5 per turn. So that's a big difference. It's significant. And I've gotten, I'm in 1600s. I think I've gotten 5 of the great scientists to this point. So, it's definitely noticeable. Aesthetically, I like the golf course. It looks cool, but it doesn't really sync up with any of his other abilities. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, no, our thoughts are pretty similar. The Scottish Enlightenment is top tier. Robert the Bruce would probably be second or third best civilization from the expansion, in my opinion, mainly based upon Scottish Enlightenment, because the extra science and production that is like science and production together is always a great combo. Getting extra great scientists and great engineer points as well, that's amazing. Make your cities aesthetic, drop a couple of those entertainment districts and just get +10% science and production and +2 great scientist and engineer points from your cities. Really, really powerful. The golf course indeed is a little bit out of place. I don't like it that much either. It's okay, though. It gives an amenity, which helps keeping your cities happy. You can have 1 per city, so you want to have probably 1 golf course per city at least. But beyond that, yeah, no, it's not that amazing.
Yeah, but, I mean, it dovetails a bit into the Scottish Enlightenment, sure, but yeah. I've only built 1, and it was more just because I thought it looked cool, and it does look cool.
It does look very cool, absolutely. And what is your opinion about the Highlander unit?
Oh, I mean, it's great. Like the Highlander, they look great, first and foremost. They've represented it well. By the way, one thing I wanted to mention, I love the music that they have for... I love the music for Robert. I love the music they have for Poundmaker. It is so great, and I love the music for Shaka. But yeah, you know, the Highlander... so I'll read out its stats. Unique industrial era unit that replaces the Ranger. Strong reconnaissance unit, +5 combat strength bonus when fighting in hill and forest terrain. We don't have a lot of forests in Scotland, but anyway, hills are fine. Obviously, there's a few of those. It seems good. I built a couple in the industrial era. I used a couple for an engagement against the city state and an engagement against Brazil. And, you know, they held their own. They didn't seem like they were getting rolled or anything like that. He didn't have much of a force to fight back against me. I think he had crossbowmen, so they were always going to defeat that. The plus five combat strength bonus, I guess you can say it's situational, but they're pretty strong inherently. So if you manage to fight someone in a really hilly terrain or in a forest with them, I feel like they'd probably be pretty OP.
And the fact that the Highlander form itself already has plus five melee strength and plus five range strength above the Ranger itself, that already makes him like a stronger unit and very useful. And if you play your cards well, you can actually get up to that promotion for a couple of scouts that you have, perhaps in the beginning of the game. That gives them, what is it, plus 20 extra combat strength, I believe?
Yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
Then I've done that once in one game as Scotland, and they were really powerful at that point. I had an army of Highlanders, and I was just... I don't even remember who I was beating the shit out, but it was a really powerful thing.
That's good. That's good. So overall, I'm generally happy with how they represented Scotland. I think that they didn't. It's not too much of a caricature. You know, it's not underpowered. I wouldn't say that they're the strongest civ in the game by any means, and I'd probably put them in maybe near the middle to bottom of my second tier. I think there's still some.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think there's still some legacy civs that are significantly ahead of them right now. They're still not my favorite. I still gravitate towards Peter the Great and Russia as my favorite civ right now. But
all right, right,
I
right,
like
right.
What they did with Robert. And I'm curious your thoughts on Poundmaker. The first game I played with Rise and Fall was with Poundmaker.
I mean, it fits, right?
Mm-hmm. It does. Like, so Poundmaker, the background to it, Poundmaker of the Cree Nation. The Cree Nation are Canadian. This is the first time there's been a Canadian civ. I know that on like all the forums and stuff, all of us are, you know, we're always politely clamoring for some kind of Canadian civ, but you know, realistically it probably would have been pretty boring to play. So rightfully so, they went with a pre-Confederation First Nation civ. Poundmaker's a really cool guy, historically too. A little bit of a historical moment aside. He surrendered to the British forces, and when he was put on trial, they basically tried to shame him into submission. And he ostensibly stood up in the makeshift courtroom and said, "Just so you know," and I'm paraphrasing here, "just so you know, you didn't capture me or arrest me. The only reason you have me here is because I surrendered." And he's a really cool guy. But I really like what they've done with the Cree. Like I said, I absolutely love the soundtrack they have for them and everything that pertains to the aesthetic. Overall, I feel like they're really good economically, obviously, but I don't feel as though they have a natural direction to go in terms of victory type. So I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, they don't have a natural thing where they gravitate towards with a victory type thing. They are very much catered to be not a domination civ. Their abilities are working best when they are peaceful, friends with everybody, and have a lot of trade routes, because trade routes is their forte. They really love having some good trade routes.
Yeah, and historically that makes sense too. A lot of the Canadian First Nation civilizations were big on the trade front with the British and the French. So, and I do know too, around the time that the Cree was announced, I know that there was some outcry amongst the actual Cree community on the real life side of things. And some of the Cree elders were saying that although they weren't really familiar with the game, they'd done some research on it, they hadn't been consulted by Firaxis, and they were a little upset about the idea of, like, you know, the Cree civilization being this militarily dominant, you know, civ that might go and conquer other people, because, and again, I'm paraphrasing here, but the elder said that's just kind of not what they're all about. And so I think it's very proper and very historically accurate that this is how they constructed the civ, with the Mekawop and with the their unique ability focused around trade and around facilitation of economic development and diplomacy as well. I feel like it definitely, obviously, helps you on the diplomatic side.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I think they did well with that. The MechWarp is actually also one of the, like, most of the nations that have a unique building or something like that, I'm not much fan of. The Outback Station of Australia is one that I do like. The Polders of the Netherlands and the MechWarp of the Cree are actually one that I really like. They are really powerful. The extra housing and production and everything, it's just really good to have and makes your cities be able to grow so much bigger in the beginning of the game when housing can actually be a large problem. And that is just, yeah, if you want to play tall or something like that, the Kree are catered well towards that.
Yeah, that's the way I felt, absolutely, too. I think that the game I went pretty deep with them on. I didn't feel like I was going to win. I was on Emperor difficulty, but I did feel like I was, you know, just, I had built up a strong, independent civ that was completely self-functioning with all of its organs working properly. So that was kind of cool to do. And so overall, yeah, I like them, and it sounds like you like them. So
I definitely do.
Yeah, generally satisfied with them. Is there any civ from Rise and Fall? And I might reach back here, too. I haven't been on the show since they released Nubia, since they released Khmer in Indonesia. And you can also include Chandragupta in this. Is there any civ, not that you think is you know, crap tier or that you want to hit with the buff stick, but any civ that you don't like, how they've represented them or how they've been kind of rolled out in the game for any reason?
That's a difficult question. Of the new civs, I don't think any of them really bugged me that much. The one that I was a little bit disappointed with maybe was Chandragupta. I think he's represented it well. But it just didn't really, like, every time he's in a game, I just get annoyed by him. And that's probably, like, maybe it's a problem that I have myself, because if he's my neighbor, which is none of my fault, he just hates me, and I don't really like that much.
So, yeah, hyper-aggressive is what you're saying.
Yeah, just being, like, spawning next to him will immediately mean that he will not like you. And if I'm, for example, playing the Kree or something like that, and I'm boxed into a corner on a continent, and my only neighbor is Chandragupta, then I'm not going to have a fun game.
Yeah, no, fair enough. He's very aggressive. He seems like one of the most aggro civs in the entire game now, which is an interesting way for India to be played. I've come up against him, but I haven't played him, but hyper-aggressive India feels a bit, I don't know, anachronistic and a bit like, it just, they just don't seem to dovetail into hyper-aggressive.
It fits Chandragupta, and playing as him is actually quite fun, going around with your Varu and stomping on all your neighbors. But, beyond that, no, I do not like seeing him in any game that I play. It just annoys me too much, I think.
Okay.
And beyond that, I don't think I dislike any representation that much from any of the civilizations. We already talked about Mapuche. It's not my favorite civ. It will never be unless they completely change it. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, I actually really like the cast that we're having. I like the diversity of that they're putting a lot of female leaders and everything like that.
Yeah.
The diversity around the globe itself. You have a Native American civ, you have African civ. Like, of course, there are a bias towards Western civilizations. But I think they try to fill the gaps quite well, and I'm really glad with that.
Good. Yeah, same. I mean, I am really glad that they seem to be making a concerted effort to make sure that they are covering as much of the globe as possible. I mean, Cree is, you know, a northern Canadian, you know, First Nations is something they've never done in any civ before. Mapuche is reaching out to South America. You know, they brought Shaka back, and they've got, you know, now some representative African civs. They even have Australia. They have Indonesia, obviously. So, they are definitely covering the globe right now. I'm actually looking right now at a neat map that someone has put together of all of the civs from the, like, basically it's a world map with all the leader and civ icons on their representative place from the history of the game. And there's no real place that's empty. I mean, three South American civs, a bunch in North America, a bunch in Africa, and then, you know, there's certain places, what else are you going to do? You're not going to have more than one Russian civ, right? And that's like half the map. So, I think they've done well. So what do you think is the natural next step for them then? The spring update seems like it was, there's a few, obviously, important changes that are coming out, but it doesn't seem like it's going to be earth-shattering. So what do you think is the next step for them, either in terms of a big mechanical change, in terms of maybe a civ or two to roll out, or maybe even in terms of a next expansion, what you think they should look at?
I think that based upon the way the Phyrexis works, we're going to see probably two, maybe three packs of civilizations with scenarios attached to it. Probably add some wonders or natural wonders or city states or anything like that in the pack, like just like they did before the expansion was released. And after that, there will be another expansion, and hopefully somewhere along that way we will get something like the World Congress, because I think we were promised the World Congress and still not here.
Yeah, and it makes sense that they would kind of parse out the release of these things. Game companies are smart. They're not going to release a 100% full polished product with every single possible imaginable thing involved in it at first, right? They're going to slowly give you things over time so you pay more money for it. And that's just how the industry works. And there's not necessarily anything wrong with that. So World Congress, I wasn't surprised when it wasn't part of Rise and Fall. Maybe a little disappointed, but you're right. I would imagine that.
Yeah, I definitely was disappointed when it wasn't in there. I was like, dang it. Because I'm pretty sure that they said after the game was released, like, the World Congress is not in. We're going to get it in, but just not yet. And just so, I just imagined that it would be the first expansion. Unfortunately, it wasn't. I think it would have fit well with all of the rest of the mechanics that were put in, but apparently we can't have everything, Dan. Who knew?
You know what? We demand it, and we demand it now, immediately. we're going to complain about it on the subreddits actively and grind you into the ground. No, we're not like that. We're both a little too old for that. Last thing I want to talk about, how much time do we have left, do you think? What
are we looking at? We have about 15 minutes left.
Great. Last thing I wanted to talk about is the three chief mechanical changes from Rise and Fall. Get your opinions on them, and I'll give mine. So those would be governors, loyalty, and ages.
So where do you want to start?
Let's start with governors.
I actually really like governors. They are really good for making a little bit of a specialization for your city, and not only your city, but also your civilization, because every one of them has a couple of abilities. You can't score all of them. Trust me, I've tried. And, their abilities are really useful. I like the governor that gives your city extra growth and the trade route towards it extra food. That ability gets introduced early into the game, and it is really powerful. And the whole system where you can go different paths in their kind of upgrade kind of tree, it works. It works well. And I didn't expect that so much when I first saw the announcement that the governor's thing was going to be a thing. I thought, well, this is going to be annoying and you have to make like stupid decisions and everything like that. But nope, I actually am pro governor system right now.
Yeah, same. I love the governor system. And I also wasn't sure what I would feel about it. I thought it would just be, it was something that they were almost adding just to add something, but the way that it's integrated, it's really fun. I haven't gotten tired of any of the governors. I feel like there's enough variety in the way that you can angle it and the way that you can advance it, that it ends up being, you can specialize cities even more, or areas even more, right? I haven't been able to abuse it to the point where it gets OP, although I heard that there's some sort of exploit you could do with, I think, Magnus is the governor.
I remember that Magnus is the governor that's going to get a review, but I'm not sure what the exploit is. I imagine it might be from Groundbreaker, which is plus 100% yields from plots, harvests, and feature removals in cities. I mean, it is really powerful, because chops down some forest and you get double yields from it. That definitely can get you a couple of wonders early in the game, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So overall, we like it. I know I like it. I know it brings a bit of spice to the games, and anything to make a game feel different than the one that came before it is good. Ages. Let's talk a bit about Ages. I remember you and Kyle talking about it, and you were positive about it, but let's reiterate maybe a bit.
Oh, yeah. I actually really love the Ages system. The history... The story timeline thing is not that much my jam. I mean, it's neat. It's there. It
makes for some good memes, though. People post into the subreddit some hilarious stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. But the Aegis system itself, with the choices that you can make and everything like that, I actually really, really like it. Me as a player that likes to min-max things a little bit more, it's beautiful to play with. There are, I've done a strategy session about it before, and which I told people like how you could go on purpose into a dark age to gain maximum profit out of things and everything like that. It is a great system with a lot of versatility, depending on which way you want to go. And you actually feel getting rewarded when you're going into a golden age and stuff like that. There are some parts of the system I do not like. Mainly the part is that once you've accomplished that you're going to be into a golden age, I always feel that I have to like put my whole civilization on pause so that I don't generate too many points afterwards. Because those points would literally just go to waste.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I do kind of hate, because you are like, your civilization is steamrolling toward that golden age, and every extra little push afterward like should propel you even further. But instead, they are just actually going to make it harder later on in the game, and I feel that might be something they need to address.
Interesting. I hadn't really thought about that. Every time I hit a golden age, I do kind of feel like maybe it's not necessarily that I prioritize era score, but yeah, it does. I guess it doesn't go towards anything, does it?
No, because the next age will just start from wherever you are at that point with the amount of points and add the whole like list of things that are added to it in general. So every point you make from there just makes the starting point for the next era higher, and you haven't accomplished anything with those points.
The triggering Dark Ages deliberately and getting the bonuses from that is really cool. Now, I'm not going to pretend that I triggered my first Dark Age deliberately, because I did. I definitely triggered it because I sucked in that specific game. But I do know that when I looked at the Dark Age bonuses, this is why I don't have them in front of me, so forgive me for not knowing exactly the Dark Age policy card. But there was the Dark Age policy cards specifically were really cool, and everything pertaining to that was neat, because it allowed you still to lean in, not necessarily to your strengths, but lean against your weaknesses in so far as a Dark Age could, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah, absolutely. My personal favorite of the Dark Age policies is isolationism. Your domestic trade routes get +2 food and +2 production, but you can't train or buy settlers or settle new cities. It's the perfect. Okay. It's a perfect card for me that it's available from the classical until the industrial era. So it's a perfect like kind of policy that I would hit maybe around the medieval era, depending on exactly when I'm done settling things. Just hit the Dark Age on purpose, go to a heroic age afterwards, and just abuse isolationism. I'm not settling any new cities at that point anymore, because I've already made all the cities that I want, and just get that beautiful extra domestic trade route bonuses.
Nice. Yeah, it does seem like a beastly one. I think the one that I remember picking had something to do with religion, because I wasn't playing religion that game, and I think there was a card Maybe if you have them in front of me, you can remind me which one that is. There was a card pertaining to religion where if you didn't have a religion or were lower on faith, that you got some sort of bonus for that.
The only Dark Age policy thing is like an Inquisition, is that you can start Inquisition with an Apostle charge, and all religious units have extra combat ability.
I don't think that's it. Maybe something else.
The only thing that sounds familiar with what you're describing is one of the Golden Age choices, actually, for religion, where your apostles get extra charges and extra movement and stuff.
That might have been it. I can't quite remember, but yeah, I do know that Dark Ages, though, was something that that was really neat. And then jumping into a Heroic Age after seems... It's rewarding, right? The Heroic Ages are very rewarding.
Oh, yeah. Have you hit a Heroic Age already?
A couple times, yeah.
And were you wearing sunglasses when you did?
the aesthetic is so rad when that happens. I love that little touch. Like, absolutely. You're going to want to ramp up your color saturation, just blind yourself in your Heroic Age.
I don't know what my display settings exactly are, but I felt like I was getting blinded anyway, because it was so bright when the Heroic Age hit.
That's right. If you need extra light in the room, just go on a Heroic Age and leave your screen on. You could probably read by that light.
But my monitor, I 100% can...
Yeah. There you go. And then the last one I want to talk about is one that I know I personally am not as huge on, and perhaps that's because I haven't really integrated it into any of my games, but that's loyalty. What are your thoughts on loyalty?
I actually like it.
Okay, whatever.
It is something that I missed from Civ 4, for example, and that's city flipping. And now I can city flip again. And I've had a small discussion with Carl about this, especially because it brings the entertainment district back in a way for offensive gameplay.
Yes, that's fair. That's
with
absolutely
the breadth and circuses, which is awesome, because the entertainment district was something I didn't want to build normally, but now it is actually something like, well, I can actually build an entertainment district here and use offensively to grab a couple of cities without declaring war. I really like that play of it. I do not completely agree on everything of it. For example, I don't always fully agree with the calculations that are made for settling cities and negative loyalty from settling in a certain positions. I think it can be too harsh in some situations and like a little bit too easy in others. Mm-hmm. But I haven't completely figured that system out and how they calculate it exactly.
Okay.
But beyond that, I think it is a fine system. I really like the fact that I can flip cities now peacefully.
And it absolutely brings amenities back into the game, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I think I remember us talking months ago about how amenities just felt a bit tacked on. I think that that's the one part of loyalty that I've really noticed, is now I have to care a lot more about, as you say, the entertainment district and all that amenities business that I kind of had really not attached onto in Civ 6, but which was so important in Civ 5.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, Civ 5 was all about happiness and getting to positive happiness and everything like that. And here, amenities were like, yeah, you want some luxuries maybe if you can. But now it is more important because you do want to keep your citizens loyal. And especially when you know you're going to a Dark Age or something like that, on purpose or not, you want to have your citizens happy so that they don't flip away from you.
Absolutely. So overall, I mean, although I'm not as crazy about the loyalty mechanic, just in the sense that maybe I've just had negative interactions with it, and it's just been cities that have been flipped away from me, and it's been a huge pain in the ass. The one thing I don't like is that I feel like maybe the loyalty strain when you try and settle a little further away from your center feels a bit disproportionate for me. Like with my Scotland game, I tried to settle a coastal city that really wasn't all that far away from the capital of Stirling, and I had huge loyalty pressure.
Yeah.
And it I think the city broke away like 25 turns after I settled it. So maybe calming that down a little bit would satisfy people like me, but maybe I just need to be better at the game. I don't know.
No, I agree. Like I said before, I don't know exactly how that calculation is made, and sometimes I feel it's a little bit irregular. It just doesn't always make sense to me.
Yeah, fair enough.
But I can recommend you to do at least one game where you actively tried to pursue a couple of enemy cities by building entertainment districts on the border of your city with their city, and just spam a couple of bread and circuses and see if you can try and flip them away. It is actually really fun to try.
So that in their dark age, they see the glowing lights of your Colosseum on the border and they want to flip to your civ, right? Is there a civ that you would recommend to do that with?
There's no real civ that has any bonus for it. So perhaps Brazil, I believe they still have the bonus for the entertainment district, if I'm correct. So makes it cheaper to build.
Yeah, they can be jealous of our Copacabanas and our street carnival.
Yeah, and you can host like cool World Cup games or something like that in your.
Exactly. Perfect. All right, I think we're winding down here. So first thing I wanted to say, folks, thanks for tuning back in and for sticking with us. We appreciate it. We hope that this has been, you know, a return to comfort, a return to that warm, soft blanket out of the dryer that is CivCast. You know, it's fun to be back on with you, Wouter. It's fun to talk.
And I'm really glad you're back as well, Dan. We have missed you here.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Like I said before, guys, we're going to try and roll out an episode once a week, and we should be able to do that. We will definitely keep the Reddit, which is reddit.com/r/CivCast, active. I'm going to post in it a little bit more. We'll post our links to web episodes and so forth in there. So I would encourage everyone to stay active on that Reddit. Oh, there was one thing I wanted to mention too, Wouter, from the Reddit, and that's the CivCast challenge. So I don't know if you saw, but yesterday our friend Pendon posted in the CivCast subreddit with his suggestion for a CivCast challenge. I'm going to read it really quickly. Seeing as there's not yet an April challenge, I figured I'd go ahead and throw one out. In honor of Tax Day, traditionally April 15th in the United States, oh God, thanks for reminding me, I challenge the community to a simple contest of generating economic power. The challenge is simple. Earn as much money as you can and then report back to the group your best turn number. I'm assuming he means coinage per turn. The game setup is up to you, but as is tradition, difficulty should at least be emperor. And then he says for him, he plans to try using Rome on a huge Pangaea map with max civs. He knows from experience it's possible to earn over 1,000 gold per turn.
Holy smokes.
Good Lord. I what do you mean you know from experience? I feel like that's absolute insanity, but
yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah, I would encourage everybody. I tell you what, I'm gonna do that for my goal this week is gonna try and see how much I can get out of maybe a pound maker game. But I would definitely encourage people to stick with the CivCast challenges. Thank you to the community for posting those and for keeping those going. Wouter, is there anything else you wanted to share?
I would like to thank people for standing by us and keep listening to us, even though we have been a little bit more irregular lately and things are a little bit more like shaky. We're trying to get our legs underneath us again and keep running. But for those that are still listening, thank you very much. The listeners are so much appreciated. We make this show for you. We love doing it, and we want to keep making it for a very long time, at least in my case. So thank you, guys.
Yeah, we love the game. We do this obviously for you guys, but also because we just like talking about it. If you have feedback for us on the format of this episode or on things that you would like us to cover, we'd really encourage you guys to post in the subreddit, particularly in maybe the comments to this episode's threads or in separate comments about topics you'd like us to cover, and we will cover them. I think that probably that should do it for us for now, Wouter. Next week, we're going to resume with my historical moment and with your strategic tip, I think is the plan.
Yes.
That's good. Yes. Yeah. Okay, good. So we will resume with those next week. So, thanks to Kyle for allowing us to continue to use the platform here to put these shows out. We hope that you guys have enjoyed it. On behalf of Wouter, as he said so eloquently, thank you for sticking with us. We're going to try and give you the best content possible moving forward. And to quote Victor Hugo, as quoted by Civilization VI, there's nothing like a dream to create the future.